the people are saying out there. It's amazing. We tore it up. We nailed it, man.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Working Title Podcast here at Atlas Plus. You've got your beautiful two co-hosts, myself and...
R Wars, always here.
And always beautiful. But today, we have a special guest, the one, the only, Anton Brimball, the founder of The Modern Insurgent. Antoine, without even trying, I'm just going to let you take it. Tell us a little about yourself, your villain origin story, and a little bit about what you're doing with the Modern Insurgent.
Yeah, awesome. No, first of all, obviously, thank you guys for bringing me on. It's a big honor as well. My name is Antoine. So it's a French name, so I guess the real pronunciation would be Antoine Brimball, but no one can say that. So just Antoine is fine. I'm the founder and editor-in-chief at The Modern Insurgent. So we're a young, but pretty, let's say, fastly rising media organization. We focus on insurgencies, rebel groups, sort of political movements around the world. We make articles, podcasts, documentaries, all the good stuff. And I guess my background story was, I'm kind of born into a political setting. So I'm very young. I'm 19 years old, but my parents, I'm half French and half Serbian, so they met during the Yugoslav wars. My dad was a UN peacekeeper, and my mom was a translator for the UN. And so they met in a UN mission in Kosovo. Since I'm alive, let's say, my parents have always been talking about politics. I've always been in a very political scenario, and I currently study international relations and politics at a university in Madrid, in Spain. And so I've always had that interest. I always knew I wanted to do something within the political field. And to be honest, journalism wasn't my initial plan, honestly. It also kind of, my passions for journalism, not to get too deep, so I hope this doesn't ruin the whole vibe, but it kind of started after the Vienna terrorist attacks in 2020. It happened like right under my window, so I was one of the main witnesses. And I was actually invited on Sky News and stuff like that to talk about it. And so that's when I realized, I want to do something. I want to try and, let's say, combat evil in this world. And at least like, I can do it by spreading truth. And so that's when my motivation started to try and get more involved in the sort of whole journalism world. And so I founded my own thing a year ago. And now here we are. I manage a team of 40 people and we make good content. But nothing is as good as being on this podcast. So thanks, guys.
Yeah, no, it's very impressive. I've been watching your guys' work grow over the past, I don't even know how long I've been following you, but I think probably close to like over like 7 or 8 or 9 months or so. It's very impressive what you guys do. And I'm always glad to see when you guys have a new article or thing out on a new insurgency group I can take a read about.
Thanks so much. Yeah.
Yeah, by all means, if you have not checked them out, what is the website? Where do they need to go to check you out?
I guess kind of our hub is our website, which is moderninsurgent.org. But we're pretty active on Instagram. I think that's our main outlet. So it's just at moderninsurgent. We post pretty much everything that we have, except, you know, we try to keep it limited because of the shadow ban. But yeah, that's a whole different story.
Yeah, you got to be watching for the ban hammer at all times, which is why we do this here at Atlas Plus. I didn't know a lot about that, about your background. That's fascinating. It's really interesting about the way your mother and father met. That's, I don't know. There's a beauty about that, kind of the rose and the rubble sort of thing.
Yeah, for sure.
Pretty cool. And that's, I didn't know that about in Vienna. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, as terrible and horrifying as something may be, it does, in some, couldn't even call it a silver lining, but in some way typically inspires others to go on and do something good. It's kind of a roundabout way, but it's kind of interesting to look at that. But you said you're currently in Belgrade, which is a pretty good launching point. You said when we were talking a little bit before the show about some of the politics of the region, the protests, some of the things going on there. As for those that don't know, and kind of segue into the show a little bit, we dabble in geopolitics, but we keep it light. But that's probably a good, easy segue right into that. I think the world they hear a little bit about it if they follow world politics. They might get a bite-sized piece, but you've got a far more in-depth, obviously personal connection to the area. What about that can you kind of share a little bit? Because that's a part of the world, like I said, you might get a bite-sized piece from Reuters or AP, but that's about it.
Yeah, of course. And honestly, since the war in Ukraine, I haven't seen that many, let's say, articles, or even there hasn't been a lot of reports on the impact of the war in other Eastern European countries. I suppose most of it has been sort of, restricted within the Caucasus or even Poland, but the Balkans have been actually pretty influenced by the war in Ukraine, because we're finding that more and more the youth, especially, let's say, the students in Serbia, are turning away from the traditional pro-Russian Serbian perspective. So this was something that obviously, Russia helped Serbia immensely during the Second World War. And so there was this, also both countries are Orthodox. So there's always been this huge connection, this huge bond between Russia and Serbia. And so, generally speaking, Serbia, I guess the population here, especially when I walk around, it is somewhat more pro-Russia than it is pro-Ukraine. You will see a lot of people supporting Putin, the war in Ukraine. They think that it's justified. And you see it, especially in football games. I'm a very big football fan. So for the Americans, I'm talking about soccer here, the real football.
I imagine the hooligans are probably crazy over there.
Yeah, for sure. And so I go to a few games here, and the vast majority of them have Donetsk flags, Luhansk flags. They're very openly pro-Russian. But that doesn't mean that it's the whole society. Usually there's always, I would say that the more radical pro-Russian perspective is always somewhat louder than the pro-Ukrainian perspective, if that makes sense. And so, Serbia has been quite fragmented with that, especially because the Vucic government, so we have a president called Aleksandar Vucic, and he's been somewhat sitting on the fence. He does support, let's say, inferior Russia, but when it comes to the UN and stuff like that, we've sort of held a neutral position, because on the one hand, Serbia knows that if it supports Russia openly, that's going to bar any hope of entering the EU soon, or even getting closer to the West. But they know that, if they don't back Russia, then all that dependency that we have on them, whether it's with gas or oil or resources or even funding, that's going to go away. So it's a tricky position, but it seems that the youth here is very driven to take a more solid stance and be more pro-Ukraine. We see that a lot with protests. Every Saturday in Belgrade, there's honestly some of the biggest protests I've seen in my life. Not in terms of violence, but in terms of size, the actual extent of mobilization is crazy. There's thousands of students, thousands of young people, and also older generations, but mostly younger people, who unite and they start marching in front of the parliament. And you see pro-Ukraine flags. You see more progressive ideologies, I suppose, more contemporary ideologies being displayed there. And so I think that reveals an interesting thing about the current situation in Serbia. Obviously, I'm half Serbian and half French, and I try my best to stay objective when I talk about Serbia, which I suppose is quite a rare thing for a Balkan person to do. Most Balkans have very, very strong opinions on a large amount of topics, but I think it's important, not only as an academic, but also as a journalist, to display the truth as it is. And so that's my observation. It seems that the younger generations are leaning more towards the pro-Western side, the pro-Ukraine side, than older generations. And that's led to a lot of, let's say, I wouldn't call it regime change, but a lot of pressure for at least a change in the government. The Serbian government is very corrupt, a lot of censorship. I was actually talking to Mike earlier before the show. I'm trying to film a documentary currently in Serbia, and I'm trying to get in touch with some students who are leading, let's say, movements or associations, to push for that, let's say, government change in Serbia. The vast majority of them are very afraid to speak to any media outlet because of censorship here. So it's not an ideal scenario, but the youth is trying to change that. So I think the war in Ukraine has influenced Serbia and the Balkans as a whole a lot more than people think. And we've seen that with the tensions in Kosovo as well. So, yeah.
It's really interesting you mentioned the youth change, because, there is a really strong historical perspective perspective of the Serbian-Russian relationship. Dating back before World War One with like Slavic relations, but then going into the World Wars, Russia's desire to go to war with Austro-Hungary, but also there's still a very strong connection, politically through that whole entrance into World War One, and then support during World War Two, as you said. So it's interesting. I was going to ask you, have you seen many clashes on the ground between pro-Ukrainian and pro-Russian youth? And then also, what has been the effect of, because I've seen reports on it, but I mean, obviously on the ground, it could be a different thing. Like, what are the effects of any Wagner propaganda? Have you seen like murals or people with patches or flags and that sort of stuff?
Yeah, actually. So I'll start with the first question about the sort of clashes. Honestly, in terms of violence, there hasn't been all that much, which is quite surprising. You know, I'm joking about it, but it's kind of true that Balkan countries are very hot-headed. So I'm surprised there hasn't been that many violent clashes yet. Most of the clashes so far have been in Kosovo because the Serbian majority areas are boycotting the elections. They think Kosovo, you know, isn't a legitimate state, so they don't want to vote for the mayors. They don't want to participate in the elections of the proclaimed Kosovo government. And so that's led to a problem because then the results are still counted. And obviously the Serbian majority areas aren't happy with the outcome. So then they say they aren't treated fairly. And there's been a lot of contact, especially between the K4 units, which are the NATO forces there. And, you know, I think this is pretty obvious, but the Serbs don't have a lot of respect for NATO, especially after the 90s. So yeah, the Kosovo situation has been where most of the clashes are. In terms of actual clashes, when we're talking about Serbia and Belgrade and stuff, I would say it's mostly been confined to football hooligans and football ultras. The rest, there hasn't been that many open air clashes. The protests here are very, very, let's say, contained by police. There's a very large police presence, so violence is well contained. But honestly, I think the biggest violence we've seen was at the very start of the war in Ukraine, or maybe even beforehand. With the end of the COVID mandate here in Serbia, there were huge clashes and people were, it was pretty big deal here in Serbia. But in terms of the, let's say, Ukraine-related conflicts, there hasn't been all that much in Serbia. And on the ground, I mean, I suppose it depends. Like, from my experience, like I said, I haven't seen that much violence, but that's not to say that there isn't all that much tension. I think there is. I forgot the second question.
Oh, yeah, sorry. I don't remember when it was. I think it was either in like February, January of this year.
Oh, yeah, about Wagner, right?
Yeah, yeah, and if, like propaganda efforts, basically. Or just people like with open support of them. Either way.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, no, sorry, I forgot about that question. I was rambling on too long. So
about the Wagner question, I do remember seeing reports as well a while back. I think it must have been around 7 or 8 months ago, from Wagner. I'm not sure if it was mercenaries or if it was sympathizers kind of walking through Belgrade, putting pro-Wagner stickers around, pro-Wagner graffiti. Although I haven't seen those myself, I do see a lot of, let's say, you know, I'm going to say propaganda just because it is a political sort of art. Now, I don't want to get too controversial, too subjective, but there are a lot of billboards, a lot of posters put up by their Serbian state that are clearly sympathizing with Russia. I think the most relevant one would be the Gazprom billboards. Now, Gazprom is like the biggest oil company, the biggest gas trading company from Russia. And they supply a lot of the energy to Serbia. And there are giant billboards around the highways, and not only just the highways, kind of in streets sometimes as well. And it's the Russian flag merging with the Serbian flag in the middle. And over it, it says Zajedno, which in Serbian just means together. So it's clearly like, you know, Serbia sympathizing with Russia. And then it says Gazprom. So in terms of that, there's definitely a lot of that in Serbia. You also see when you walk around the center, you see a lot of T-shirts being sold by kiosks with like the Z on it, pro-Putin graphics, stuff like that. So as far as the art goes and as far as the graffiti goes as well, especially in low-income neighborhoods, there is a lot of pro-Russian stuff. But I haven't seen anything directly related to Wagner. I do remember seeing some reports that there were at least stickers or like rumors that they were walking around Belgrade. And if anything, you know, obviously this is just purely speculation now, but if anything, if they would be in Serbia, I would suppose it would have something to do with Kosovo. Because I think that's the only rational way. Let's say if Wagner was hypothetically here, I suppose they would only be providing support for the Serbian forces in Kosovo.
Yeah, I remember that was what people were sort of, projecting or speculating about when those images first arrived there. just because of, I think at that point there was also tensions between Kosovo and Serbia.
Yeah. Yeah, no, there were a lot of tensions. I think the most recent ones, I touched on them earlier, but it has to do with the local elections. A lot of Serbs are sort of boycotting all of that, especially after, it must have been over 6 months ago now. Not sure if the timeline is completely correct. But when the Kosovo provisional government wanted to ban all Serbian license plates, so a lot of Serbs that were like truck drivers or stuff like that in Kosovo would just blockade the roads, and they would just like protest against that, because in their eyes, it was just the first step to completely eliminating Serbs from Kosovo. You know, from what they perceived, it was, well, first you ban our license plates, then you're going to ban our vehicles as a whole, then you're going to ban us from our jobs, and then you're just going to kick us out of Kosovo, which for them is Serbia. So, it's an interesting perspective to consider. And as far as the Balkan goes, it's always been like a melting pot like that. And that's why the Balkan wars were also so violent, especially in Bosnia. For over, let's say, 100 years now, all the different origins of the Balkans have been mixing together, have been marrying together, have been making children together, living in each other's countries. So when the war broke out, it was, hell on earth, basically. You had people like Serbs living in Bosnia who didn't want to belong to Bosnia once it gained independence. And so now you have Republika Srpska, which is like this autonomous region in Bosnia, which belongs or is allegiant to Serbia. That was kind of everywhere in the Balkans. And so in Kosovo, that's kind of repeating itself. You do have a lot of Serbs who want to stay with Serbia, but they don't even consider it staying with Serbia because they don't even question whether they're being separated. You know, for them, Kosovo is still Serbia. So it's crazy. Like the politics in the south are pretty tense. And I think now more than ever, especially even if there's not directly protests, we've seen the K4 units try and get reinforcements. They're trying to, let's say, be more prepared for a Serbian, a potential Serbian advance, especially with the new resolution. I think it was the resolution 1224, if I'm not mistaken. The politics right now are very, very violent, or at least prone for disaster.
It's certainly seeming like, it's another resurgence of the powder keg of Europe kind of trope. Even though, we'll see what it really pans out to, because, it's not like there has been a particularly many periods in the Balkan history that were super peaceful. So tensions are tensions. It's probably better than what was happening a couple hundred years ago. Mike, how do you feel about Russian sort of stuff in Georgia? Do you think it's like comparable in terms of, obviously, Georgia is not, aligned to Russia in the same way Serbia does, but, being a state where Russia tries to project its power. And then, of course, recently with all that sort of stuff with the tourists, and then, interestingly, some of them making very inflammatory comments after getting off those cruise ships.
Yeah. So we were, Antoine and I were even talking a little bit about that before the show a little bit, just the parallels and also the perpendiculars, the things that are totally different. Like, Antoine, you mentioned, what's the sentiment towards the, you have a pretty divided, sentimentalities in Serbia, where there's a significant, you have billboards. I think if a billboard like that, like you mentioned, with together with the Russian flag showed up here, it would probably be burned down by the next day.
It's usually the Ukrainian graffiti that gets vandalized.
Oh, bro. And if you showed up to a Tbilisi Dinamo, which is like the local football club, if you showed up with soccer, whatever, I'm American, but it's football. It's football. If you showed up to a Tbilisi Dinamo game and waved a Russian or a Donetsk or Luhansk or any of that stuff, having lived here in Tbilisi, I would predict a very high chance of you getting a piece of metal shoved in your stomach. At high velocity, whether at bullet speed or at hand speed, because it just doesn't fly here, especially at the ground level. Like politics and the politicians, the ruling party in parliament right now, it has its foibles. We'll call it that. I'll try to be unbiased. I'm not very good at doing that when it comes to the politics here, but they have their foibles and their question marks, but at the ground level, there's an overwhelming support, I would say, for Ukraine. Like I said earlier, before the show, like you walk down the street in Tbilisi, you probably see just as many Georgian flags sitting on people's balconies than you do Ukrainian flags. Whenever there's protests, there's people waving Georgian and Ukrainian flags and EU flags and occasionally a NATO flag, which is, I guess, okay, I guess. like, you know, people, even at work, like there's people I see in like an office settings that'll just have a Ukrainian button on their bag or something like that, or pin. There's certainly a very pro-Ukraine, pro, or I should say anti-Russia, anti-Kremlin sentimentality. And it's pretty firm here. I think another thing I mentioned was like the connectivity between Ukraine and Georgia. I think the Slavic Brotherhood and the connection that Serbia and a lot of that general area kind of has with Russia still rings true today. Georgia doesn't have that because Georgians are not Slavic. Kind of a popular misconception. They are not Slavic. They are Kartvelian or Kartli people, which is a look. This isn't an anthropological podcast, but in a nutshell, it's basically just people that came from this particular area and formed in this particular area a long time ago before history. They're Kartli people. They're not Slavic. Sure, there's the Georgian Orthodox Church, but that's becoming more and more unpopular, especially by the youth. So I think you know people associate with the religion and less with the church nowadays, if that makes sense. So Russia has, with the exception of Russia's claws in the government that I would say that do exist, and I have receipts for that. Other than that, they really have no claws with the people, and that's sort of upsetting to the Kremlin. Georgia, as we saw with Patrick, or our wars mentioned, that there is a there was a recent protest in the port city of Batumi. Sadly, I was not able to make it out there, and the protests here in Tbilisi were kind of a nothing burger, so there was nothing there to really report. But the ones in Batumi were actually pretty violent. They were clashing with police, throwing eggs at the buses that were taking the Russian tourists off, and the Russian tourists that were interviewed were saying some pretty raunchy stuff as far as you know, Russian imperialistic rhetoric, saying how Georgia is part of Russia and should be a part of Russia, and Abkhazia was liberated from the Georgians, and this sort of thing that's pretty much just poking the bear at this point, or poking the Georgian tiger at this point. Going back to the question is, we really don't see the same level of involvement. Like you wouldn't see a pro-Russian hoodlum gang. They would be overrun and beaten to a pulp before the cops got there.
And actually, if I may jump into that, we in our own podcast at the Modern Insurgent, we spoke to this UK-based photographer called John Bulletin. He went to Georgia and a couple times, and he took photos, like very close-up photos of the Elita hooligans. They're the hooligans of that one club you mentioned earlier, Dinamo Tbilisi. And it was interesting because he mentioned that in one of the first games where he joined the hooligans in the stadium, which is insane, by the way, because that's incredibly hard to do, especially if you're a tourist or a journalist. There were the Elita hooligans managed to identify two Russians sitting on the right of like their cages. And they told them, you know, I'm sorry, pardon my French, but, you know, that quote for, you know, word for word, they said, fuck Russia. And then the Russians just pointed back a middle finger. They just flipped them off. And so the Elita hooligans jumped over the cage and just beat them up in the stadium. So I think what you're saying is completely right. Yeah, you wouldn't see that sort of pro-Russian sentiment in Georgia.
Yeah, those protests in Batumi, there's a reason, especially the second night of protest, there was a ton of not only like police, riot cops, and special response units because they're very, you know, they're not dumb. They know what the Georgians will do. Especially if they got on board that ship, it would just look like something out of Master and Commander for those that have seen when they board the ship and it's basically just an all out brawl. It would have looked like that, swinging bottles and anything that comes within arm's distance. It would have been bad, because there is a pretty strong anti-Russian sentiment. Now, to be fair, there are pro-Russian enclaves. I was telling earlier about how I lived in some pretty remote villages before, and one of the taxi drivers that I frequently used routinely had the old Lada Zhiguli, the old Russian kind of boxy looking car. He had a bright red jacket that had like the two stripes down the sleeve, not the three knockoff. But on the back, he had the not just the sickle and hammer, not just the sickle and hammer on the globe, but the sickle and hammer, the globe, and the sheaths of, or what are they, the wheat sheaths, whatever it's called, the wreath of wheat, and the little scrolls that, you know, name off every single SSR, Oblast, whatever. Like, he was full on, had like faded pictures of Lenin and Stalin on his dashboard. It's a real thing. And sure, he might have some drip, but that is pretty hardcore from an ideological standpoint, especially in a country that arguably under both of those leaders was brutalized, certainly the latter, Stalin. And then following that has routinely been kind of abused by the quote-unquote fatherland, the motherland, if you will. It's not been a great story for Georgians. So it's a very interesting dynamic, and that's why I like to look at the perspective of Serbia, because it's like you get a very different world there, where a lot of that's very not only accepted but advertised, like you said.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. Yeah, and I think it goes even beyond just the state putting up those billboards, or, you know, like I'm not sure if it would be the state in that case, but it would be Gazprom. But either way, you know, if you're associating the Serbian flag with the Russian flag, you've obviously gotten clearance from the state. But it's also the people, a lot of the graffiti. There's a lot of graffiti in Belgrade, especially in the sort of brutalist areas, you know, where it's like the architecture is very brutalist. And you see a lot of like giant graffitis that are honestly huge. And they're either anti-NATO or saying that Kosovo is Serbia, or just pro-Russian graffiti. Like, that's the three main types of graffiti you'll see in Belgrade at the moment. So yeah, I suppose that is the sort of perpendiculars and opposites that we were talking about compared to Georgia.
I think that's interesting. And I wrote an article, God, this must have been years ago at this point, for Georgia Today, just a local paper here, about street art. And look, I'm not an art connoisseur. In fact, I might be farthest from. I'm kind of a dunce when it comes to that thing. I'm a flathead. I don't know any of that stuff. But I kind of, you can kind of gleam a lot of about a youth, but also a popular direction, kind of the way the cultural winds blow by graffiti. Now, some of it's just trash and people tagging their name, but there's a lot of it, I think, that you can kind of dive into about where a country's going at a granular level using that, you know. For example, like, you've got I would call a serious socio-political division in Serbia based off what you've said about the street art. With Georgia, a lot of it's anti-government. Just walking down to the supermarket, like at the end of one of the main streets I live at, I don't know how many fuck Russias I see. If I had a dollar for how many fuck Putins I saw spray painted on the side of one of those commie block buildings, apartment buildings, I could probably buy a week's groceries with that. I mean, there's a lot of this anti-Russian stuff. And then there's occasionally like just a spray painted Georgian flag, something patriotic, something about, you know, glory to the heroes. I think you can kind of see where I'm going with this. There's a significant, it's like a litmus test, I guess, is the best way to describe it.
It's interesting you mentioned that. It's so interesting because in contrast, I think about the U.S. compared to like other countries when it comes to like the level that graffiti plays in political or social movements now. Because really in the U.S. it's all like artistic or commercial. I mean, there are underlying messages behind stuff and people will definitely try to do it. But, really think I saw that many fuck Trump or fuck Biden graffitis, right? There might've been like some kind of like humor, you know, sort of comical depiction of them. And then, you know, everyone's seen like a big thing in the US is right next to the gas prices. People will put little stickers with like Biden pointing and a little speech bubble that says, I did that. And it's like, cause you know, obviously there's like an association with his administration and rising gas prices. But like, when I try to think of like nationalist or like patriotic or anything like that, like the only thing that even comes close, which is the furthest thing from being, you know, a real patriot, in my opinion, which is Patriot Front, which is, for people who don't know, is a far right a white nationalist organization in the U.S., which does really shitty graffiti everywhere. But it's so funny because like it's the only thing I can think of, and even them, it's like I see those like once every couple months or something. Like they're very spread apart. Like they're not at all concentrated. And usually it's like at a gas stop or like a parking area on the pull off of a freeway or something. Just an interesting like dichotomy between like the way that, you know, graffiti or art is used to portray political movements.
No, yeah, I think also it has a big overlap with the extent to which censorship is present in a society. I've noticed this a lot, but a lot of the times when, I mean, in the US, the amount of political posting on, let's say, social media and stuff is something that wouldn't necessarily be possible, for example, in Serbia. And so I have a feeling that, just from like a brief observation, that I suppose street art is more of a, like a more of a tool to share your political ideologies in countries where you can't necessarily do so using your like non-existent free speech sometimes, I suppose, you know? So I think that's why if you go perhaps to the US or honestly, even the UK or France or Germany, you won't find that much political graffiti. But if you go more towards the East, Eastern Europe side of things, then you'll get a lot of graffiti. Now, of course, that's also just because people do more graffiti by default. But I think that it's also because it's a safe way of being able to put out political messages. So yeah, that's definitely something I've noticed as well.
That's a really good point.
I didn't think about that. Yeah, that's like first world, like me like being blind, because I'm like, yeah, you just say whatever you want on the internet without consequences. Yeah.
Yeah, no, unfortunately, yeah, that's not. I mean, don't get me wrong. I wouldn't go as far as to say that Serbia has absolutely no freedom of speech. Far from that, you know. Especially when you compare it to other parts of the world, we have it good here. It's just that, especially with the Vucic government, you can't just be saying
it's a big case of also just like, you know, I mean, not even necessarily like a crackdown, but just the fact that you might be put on a list or you're under surveillance or a police officer comes and says, hey, we're watching your activity, or they just, you know, or someone just, you know, online who's not associated with the state sees it and like wants to come beat you up or something. Which just might be more like common in a place where it's like nationalistic sort of, you know, fervor is more likely to sort of rise around certain events or people posting things online, like especially if they're like a celebrity or something.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think that's a very apt comparison. It's almost not only is it a gauge of where the people are pointed, where the kind of the winds of the population are blowing, but also the level of, yeah, I guess freedom of speech is where it's at. Like you said, in Serbia, it's a little tougher. You don't get away with everything. Maybe a little bit more freedom. You come over to Georgia where you can get away with a little bit more, but still, I know journalists who have been not necessarily arrested. I guess the proper term is detained, more for just being an inconvenience than anything else. I haven't probably just, I've written some pretty disparaging things about the government, and, but I've never had anybody really be a problem. Like the law enforcement has always been very courteous to me. As I say that, the SWAT team come kicking my door, but I've never had a real problem. And it's a little bit nicer, but again, I do know people, I have heard of people who have been, you know, all of a sudden arrested under mysterious, you know, you didn't pay your taxes 20 years ago or some shit like that. And they got arrested, but it was more because we obviously all knew they wrote or they published something. And then you kind of get to the US where, why would you go through the pain and struggle of buying the spray paint and finding a place to put fuck Trump? Just go on Facebook. Nobody's going to say anything again. Depending on your friends group, you might get celebrated.
Yeah, and in all honesty, I mean, probably, you know, for most people in America, the amount of reach they're going to get between graffiti and a Facebook post is probably going to be the same. But the only difference is a Facebook post they don't have to leave their house for, and they can order McDonald's while they do it.
No, I think like I have a good example to like kind of back up, especially what you were saying, Mike, about what's happening in Georgia. Like, there's this one politician or member of parliament in Serbia. Her name is Maria Lukic. And I actually just found out about her a few days ago, because when I arrived in Serbia, I saw there was graffiti with her name, like absolutely everywhere. And I was wondering, you know, like, who is this? What's the background? What's the backstory to this? Basically, it's this member of parliament in Serbia who revealed that there were a bunch of sexual assault let's say, well, she made a bunch of sexual assault allegations from a mayor in Serbia. And that mayor obviously wasn't too happy with those allegations. So he threatened, you know, to kill her multiple times. Like, it's pretty serious stuff. And so there's a lot of graffiti around Belgrade. I haven't seen it in other parts of Serbia, but I suppose it's there as well. With her name and under her name, there's always a quote. And like the quote is different every time, but it's a quote that she's been told either by the media, by the government, or by that mayor. And so that graffiti is a way of showing solidarity with her. And I find that, like, I guess a good example of how when something gets suppressed, not necessarily because there isn't freedom of speech, but maybe also just because politics are corrupt, graffiti is always a way of bringing awareness to a specific thing. I mean, when I say the Maria Lukic graffitis are everywhere, I mean, like, genuinely everywhere. You'll see them every block. And on every single block, you'll see graffiti with her name. And so, I mean, it made me gain attention about it. And I'm just a French-Serbian guy that comes here every, like, 5 or 6 months. So it's
people supporting her, you're saying, right? Like, in saying,
yeah, exactly. People are supporting her cause. People are supporting. They're trying to shed light that, you know, like, her allegations are, at least they have to be heard, or that they're valid, you know, because the government has kind of been just ignoring them and trying to brush it under the carpet. So, yeah.
Yeah, you see, threatening to kill each other is a normal pastime in American politics, so we don't get that worked out.
Yeah, nothing. Yeah, sadly, you just don't get, at least when I lived in the U.S., it's like, yeah, everything's so milquetoast and boring. Everything's so nice. Whereas here, yeah, the same thing as, you know, get a good old fist fight in parliament, you know, threaten to kill each other.
I would pay so much money to watch Mitch McConnell get hit in Congress. just to watch what would happen to his body from like a single tap.
Well, that's the other thing. It's like, if you look at most of the parliament, like, I don't know parliament in Serbia, but I would imagine it's similar to parliament in Georgia, where most parliamentarians, like here in Georgia, are like my age, kind of in their early 30s, late 20s, going into maybe the 40s. You really don't have people that are pushing into the 60s, 70s, certainly not in the 80s. They're living in a retirement, like, villa outside the city. You know, they're done. Whereas in the U.S., it's like, dude, everybody's over the age of 70. What? Like, how many? I guess you got like AOC, who's young and hip and fresh and face, but
yeah. But it's like, yeah, if you look at the general, I mean, and most of the people who are like under the age of whatever, like 30, whatever, which is like the middle age of that, but most of the people who are under that have only entered politics very recently. I mean, they are young, so obviously, no shit, but like, they're also, you know, it's like, as in, like, these, this is only recently that American politics has started shifted. More young from an overall perspective, even though, I mean, there is, you know, always an influx of them. There's just always more people who are waiting out their seats. And a lot of it in America, I think, comes down to because of how weird the legislation gets when someone's out of office, when there's an election, or when, like, the incumbent stops being there. People have, like, this thing where they just, you know, they get people's names in their heads, and they want to vote for them over and over again. But, you know, there's a fear of, like, from both parties that if they change out those names, or if there's other people there, then, like, they'll lose the vote, which is definitely sometimes going to happen. But, I mean, at the same time, I usually find incumbents from both the Democratic and Republican parties are usually worse candidates than newcomers, just because they're complacent. And usually, if you look at, they just, it's, you know, like a long career of 10 years of doing absolutely nothing for their constituents.
Of course, you rest on your laurels. You've got your kickback money. You kind of cue the stereotypical boss hog, where he's got his thumbs under his suspenders, and he's resting in his kickup chair. Boy, I ain't got to do nothing. I just got to sit here and make a few thousand dollars. So I think, I think you're exactly right. There's that complacency where they don't really have to move too much, and like, you know, eerily similar to that same guy with the Soviet jacket that longs for the old Soviet Union, because it was a constant. He knew, even though it's a shitty existence, he knew every day it was a guaranteed standard of shitty. He knew he was going to get a loaf of bread, cheese, vodka, potatoes. Life sucks, but it sucks for everyone, and it sucks the same every day. Where I guess that's maybe the same when you just vote the same person in consistently. It might suck, but it's consistent. It's predictable.
Yeah, I mean, it's the saying, you know, the devil you know versus the devil you don't. You know, it's people are more likely to trend towards stuff they're familiar with, even if necessarily they know it's not the best for them in the long run, or if it's not really like in anything different or better. It's just, you know, comfort and in familiarity and knowing what to expect, because then you don't know what to expect, then things get scary.
What two Congress people would you want to see in the ring? Go.
Oh, man. I wouldn't mind Matt Gaetz and Ted Cruz. I want to see. I want to see them fight each other, because it's kind of like the like old, like, you know, old stock versus like the new, you know, blood, fresh blood coming in, and they're both kind of just really shitty people. So I think I'd cheer each time one of them got hit. So,
but then Ted Cruz is a hefty boy. He's got some weight.
Oh yeah, he's got hefty weight. But Matt Gaetz has like the predator speed. You know, he's like the guy who like he runs from Chris Hansen and he like almost makes it away.
Oh, Chris Hansen. Oh,
why don't you have a seat there? Why don't you have a seat right there,
Matt? Why don't you have a seat right here, Matt? Put down the pizza.
I was just here to talk to her. I was just going to talk to her about it. Oh, yeah, I've watched some of those episodes. Oh, God, yeah. I love it.
If you listen to his testimony when he was, like, trying to plead guilty or plead not guilty to those crimes, it, like, reads exactly like one of those episodes, too.
Oh, my God. What about in Serbian parliament?
Well, I wouldn't have to hypothesize because they do just generally brawl there anyway. Yeah. So, I mean, it actually happened. There's no need to be making hypotheticals here. I mean, it's happened already. And I think the most recent one was in the Kosovo parliament. There were videos circulating like 2 weeks ago, I think it was, of like members of parliament just throwing chairs at each other and trying to fight each other. More entertaining than the WWE, honestly.
Oh, I'm not totally against how, look, people always say violence doesn't solve the answer, but does it?
It does relieve stress. I'll say, you know, like.
It selects a victor, and a victor gets to, like, come on, like, at some point, what do we say? Look, I'm not saying we should live in some, like, muscleocracy where, like, just the biggest dude becomes the prime minister.
Muscleocracy.
I don't know what a buffocracy, a liftocracy.
Liftocracy, yeah, I like that.
Yeah, we don't have a liftocracy where it's just the most shredded dude becomes parliament, and then the most like jacked guy with the broadest shoulders gets to be, you know, prime minister. But there is some credit to say maybe the biggest, baddest dude should have a say. And what is it? The old Ron Swanson. Once said, you know, maybe the best way to choose the world leader is in a decathlon. And once this person achieves like the supremacy, physical supremacy and intellectual, you say, I'm obviously not gonna do that.
It's decathlon and then a chess game.
Yes. Yes. And then at the end of it, they have, and then like that person just sits in a room with access to all the nuclear weapons.
And then you don't give them any input. You just let them decide what to do.
No, and they can have whatever food they want. And I think Ron includes women are brought to him when he desires.
Yeah, and like eggs and bacon, yeah.
Yes, eggs and bacon and shrimp, I believe is what it is.
I mean, honestly, I do think there is, you know, my viewers might be aware of this little theory I have, this little proposition I've risen over the years. I don't think it would be a bad idea to reinstitute some type of gladiatorial combat into society. Now, not necessarily as a death sport, although, you know, there are, you know, contingencies which, of course, make that possible. For instance, if you were, like, you know, dealing with, like, very violent criminals and you just kind of wanted them, you know, get rid of them. In terms of people, like, voluntarily opting in to gladiatorial combat, I think that there are so many people out there who have like anger or aggression or frustration inside of them. And instead of like, you know, them joining the police or the military and, you know, hurting someone because they're like, they're pissed off and they want to be in a position of power, or, you know, them fucking like bullying someone or killing someone or, you know, whatever, being an asshole at work, et cetera, to whatever degree of psycho they are. they just go into the gladiatorial arena and just fight that combat off, you know, fight the blood red, you know, the bloodlust off. And then, we get less psychos in society. And then they also kind of take each other out kind of, I don't know. It seems like a win-win.
Actually, that reminds me, there's this one, sorry, if I may just add, because, you know, it's surprisingly, like, there's actually a thing that's similar to that. I don't remember if it's in Peru or if it's in Chile, but there's this one traditional, like, I guess you call it a celebration, where once a year, people in a small village who have, let's say, like, a feud or a dispute.
I remember this. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's, like, once a year, and it actually works. Like, after the fight, people hug each other, and they feel, like, liberated from that, like, let's say, dispute that they've had for the past months or so. And they hold it once a year, if I'm not mistaken. And it's like a whole event. There's this one photographer who went there, took up close photos. They're in their traditional outfits, just beating the living shit out of each other. And then at the end, there's just, I guess, maybe someone who won it, maybe not. But they just hug it out. And I guess it works for them.
I mean, see, the problem is when we try that in America, you get the Purge movies.
Yeah, I guess the U.S. would make that more extreme.
The U.S. is like that, but then everyone has a firearm. And then just imagine it goes.
Really fast, yep.
Yeah, it would get
canceled.
It works better on a Peruvian village scale, unfortunately. Although I do think if you could, like, mandate everyone only having, like, fists, but I feel like some people would still take it too far.
I mean, doesn't Texas have this one, what's it called, this law, is it... Oh man, I'm not sure what it. I think it's mutual combat.
Oh yeah, there's mutual combat laws. I think the biggest problem is, like, no one's. I think there was, like, someone who tried to, like, test it, and then they got arrested because, like, I think the police learned about it beforehand. But, like, no, I don't think anyone's managed to do it and then, like, have it brought to court. So it's the law is, like, from, like, the 1700s or some shit. It's just, like, nobody's touched it since then. So it's just, like, one of those things that sits there. I don't know. I mean, you could probably get away with it. I think the problem is also it's just...
intoxication. I suppose most people who agree on it are very intoxicated, so...
Yeah, like, there has to be argument for, like, state of mind. And then also the fact is that, I mean, it's, like, Texas. So it's, you know, very, very likely to devolve into something more violent, which becomes a crime.
Yeah, no. For sure.
I don't. And there's, like, the government doesn't like it when you try to find loopholes around hurting people.
Interesting.
Unless you're part of the government.
Blood feud. So it got me going. I started going down a rabbit hole on Google. There's actually in northwestern Georgia, in a kind of a area called Svaneti, they actually still have. Well, the government, the police have problems with blood feuds because a lot of the old families there have been living there for thousands of years and they haven't moved. They still have, like, territorial claims. Like, it's still a thing, dude.
It's like the ultimate Hatfield and McCoys.
And that times whatever number of, like, families are in the region. Like, it's serious. I can't remember how long ago one of my friends, who's also a journalist, does 10 times the work I do. He's amazing. Went up there a while ago, I think, like with another older journalist, and went up. I think he did, I want to say something like interviews and what. Anyways, so I think it was 2010 or 2012. I can't remember exactly, but there was this whole, like, feud where I guess one of the sons of a family had premarital sex with the daughter of another family. Which, when you're talking about hyper-Orthodox mountain village families, is a sin against God himself. Premarital sex is a big no-no. You're also talking about Orthodox Christian families that it's yeah. So they tried to hide it, and I guess somehow, like, through the friends, like, you know, gossip, it got to the family. And the one of the fathers, or, like, one of the uncles of the girl, swore to kill the man, and you can't just be like, I declare I'm going to kill this guy. You have to actually, like, kill a goat, and then you have to spill that blood in a line across your house or your yard.
Wait, is this, like, legal precedent?
Yeah, so it goes back thousands of years. It's like a whole thing in the Swan culture.
Georgia is cooler than I thought,
bro. So, like, he slaughtered the goat and did the whole blood thing, and then he legit got, like, I think, like, a hunting shotgun or a bolt action, like, he got a rifle and was like, yeah, I'm gonna go kill this guy. Like, we have to do it. The blood has been spilt, and I have to kill this man, this boy. He has soiled a woman of the family, and so that's like the only way you can get out of this situation is for another person to be killed. And so, or I think you can pay. Hold on, what did my article say? I think it was like 4 or 5 oxen.
I love it. That's such medieval shit. It's like, this man has to be killed. There's no other way. This is the only way. Or you can pay me 4 or 5 of your cattle.
Well, when you're in the mountains, man, an oxen, dude, that's like generations worth of food and milk. That's big stuff, man. That's big bucks. And so true, apparently, yeah. Again, through the gossip, through the grapevine, the police got a wind of it. And they did a whole thing and like interdicted the guy, picked him up, and was like, hey, you can't kill this guy. And of course, the police are from the area. So they're like, yeah, we understand you got to kill this guy, but you can't because it's 20 or it's like 2012 or whatever. It's like, you can't just go knock off a dude because he, you know, got handsy with, you know, one of the women of the family. Like, you can't do that, especially since it was, at least from what I understand, consensual. Like, it was just them being dating teenagers or whatever, 20-something-year-olds. And so there was this whole, and I remember he told me, like, there was a whole court battle that actually took into account all this stuff, like this ancient law and stuff. And I forget what it came out to be, but it was like something where I think the son had to leave the region. Like, he was essentially banished, kind of like what we would, what do they call it in, like, U.S. law, where you're, I don't know, deported? Not allowed to, sort of like deported, but not really deported from a country. You're just deported from the region. Like, you're not allowed to be, it was near Mestia.
Can you be banned from U.S. states? Is that a thing? I don't honestly don't know.
I think you can, but
I'm sure. You can have warrants in some states and not warrants in another state, which is kind of like being banned there, because if they catch you, you're in trouble.
Yeah, it's kind of like that. Like, I'm sure if everything the story said was true, like, if the guy goes back there, he's either going to be killed or he's going to be arrested.
No, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled 100 years ago that no American can be banned or prevented from entering or living in any state in the country. It's just, if you got in trouble there, they're going to arrest you if they find you. Because I know there's people who will, like, get warrants in states and then just never go back to that state again, which is, like, works until you get arrested in another state. Which sometimes they will just find your records and then extradite you to that state, not deport you. They'll just, like, they'll just call up the police department and be like, "Hey, we have him. You can subpoena him for a court date or whatever."
Yeah, but it was a whole thing, and it still continues today. Like, apparently, it wasn't as severe as this, but there was something else where I think two guys got in a fight, and it wasn't like a blood oath, but it was like a blood curse or something on the family of another. Like, they were having dinner, or it was something where two guys got in a fight and they threatened to kill each other, and the police had to get involved and basically do the Georgian equivalent of a restraining order, because they were like, yeah, if these two guys actually come into contact, they'll end up there. It's a guaranteed fight to the death because of, like, ancient lore. I'm like, dude, that's raw. That's hardcore. Oh, man.
I had never heard of that. That's crazy.
It's Georgia goes hard, especially in these remote mountain regions. Dude, in these remote mountain regions, like Mestia, like, which is the Sfaneti northwestern area, and then Tusheti, which is the northeastern area, like, closer to Chechnya. Bro, some of those places, like, not only are they hyper-traditional in their lifestyle and beliefs, And religion, like, they still have, like, pagan shrines, but they'll basically just take, like, a little wooden cross and put it there, and that way it's okay. I'm not joking. They have animal skulls and shit in, like, little stone shrines, and then they just put a little cross there, so now it's the modern version.
That's so funny. That's, like, literally just how, like, that is very much how, like, local traditions, like, historically will convert, which is just, they'll just take everything from their existing religion and it'll just, like, change the symbols a little bit and, like, add some traditions in the old ones. It's interesting. I took African studies classes, and that's literally, like, how basically every indigenous religion reacted to whenever they got like close to Christianity or Islam, they would just take all the stuff from their indigenous religion and then they would just like start wearing like crescent moons or crosses and stuff.
Yeah, man. I mean, there was one village called Diklo, and it's this, again, remote village. Most of the buildings in town are protected. I think it's UNESCO, maybe something similar. And they're like these old shale towers and houses and stuff. Adjacent to the village is like a little creek, and on the other side of that is this massive hill that on the top of it, it has a large stone and then a stone cross. The large stone is where like every, I think, August or around this time of year, kind of the getting close to the harvest season, they slaughter a white goat. And it's like, dude, that's not a Christian thing, but I get where you're coming from, and it's pre-Christian.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure if you went, I'm sure if you found some original adopters of the Bible, they're probably sacrificing animals out there.
Yeah, because it's a holdover from the pagan era. I mean, old habits die hard, right?
Yeah, and I mean, we kind of have a weird... I feel like humans have always kind of... Like, no matter where you go in the earth, everyone was kind of at one point just like, I mean, maybe if we kill this thing, things will get better.
Yeah, I mean, at some point, you know, you pray or meditate or do enough, you know, alms to a certain being or whatever it is, and it doesn't work. Well, you're like, what if I, you know, because you got to think to give something to someone that is on the quote unquote other side, you have to cross the barrier of life and death. So in order to give them this goat, which is a valuable piece of livestock, or the sheep or whatever it is, you have to kill it. So it'll pass on to the other side and hopefully they'll receive it. It's kind of like trying to hand something through a hole in the wall. You're just going to put it through there and hope you get it there, like a glory hole.
Like a religion.
It's like a religious glory hole with goats and sheep. And you're just kind of hoping that sheep gets to the other side of the religious glory hole. Do you guys have anything like that in Serbia?
Yeah, I was gonna say, is there any weird like blood rituals or pagan stuff that you know about in Syria?
Or are we just absolute psychos over here?
As far as I know, we don't have anything like that. Although, like it depends on the regions you go, but obviously the more south you go, or sometimes even the closer you go to Bulgaria and stuff, you'll get some like very interesting elements of like Serbian culture that don't exist anywhere else. So like nothing as badass as the ones in Georgia, like the fight to the death type of stuff. But I did go one day. I spent a week in a small village called Bela Palanka, and it's like insanely small, insanely remote, very, very, let's say, low income village. And it's at the border with Bulgaria, if I'm not mistaken. And there are a lot of like babushkas there, like traditional outfits, all of that. And so, well, like that.
You guys had the original vampires, right? That's where I think vampires come from, Serbia.
It might be. Damn, I'm actually clueless on that. You might be teaching me a story here.
It comes from vampire. It was English, from French, came from German, came from Serbian.
Fair enough. Well, I've just learned something about our own culture. There you go.
Tell us right now, are you a vampire? Here on Atlas Plus.
There's a reason why I wanted this podcast to be at night, guys. Come on.
We have it here, live on Atlas Plus, confirmed.
It's saying Baba Yaga is Serbian, but I think that's kind of like a Slavic thing in general.
I don't know if you can actually trace where that came from, because that's like, because I think Baba Yaga came from like, the Baba Yaga today, from my understanding, is like an amalgamation of different, like basically different versions of what is now the Baba Yaga that came from everywhere, like Serbia and as far west as like Poland to as far east as, I don't know, Yakutsk.
Apparently, Serbia has dragons. That's like their mythological creatures. They have Azdaja and Zmaj.
Oh, yeah, Zmaj. Yeah, that's true. But the thing is, I was going to say, we were talking about the Baba Yagas, and have you guys seen that one? I guess it was like modern sort of, what I guess you could call it, like Serbian mythology, that Serbian dancing grandma. Have you guys seen the videos of that?
Oh yeah, dude, that should kind of give me a little bit like spine tingles, I'm not gonna lie.
It's like urban legend.
Yeah, you describe it. You probably know like way better details than I do.
Yeah, it's like this urban legend. Of, like, there's like a dancing Serbian grandmother in the streets, and if you see her dancing at night, you have to run because as soon as she spots you, you're like practically guaranteed death. She'll start running after you and just kill you with a knife. And like there was these Serbian guys who made a parody of the video, so they fully got their grandma to start dancing in the street, and they started filming it, and it became a whole like trend on TikTok. Everybody was making memes about like, oh, if you see a Serbian grandmother dancing, run. So it was It was a bit like the fog is coming, but just with the Serbian grandmother version of that.
Yeah, I remember seeing the videos and reading the comments, and then I was like, what the hell is this? Then I had to go look it up.
Yeah, no, it was funny when we see like an element of like contemporary Serbian culture just go widespread like that for no reason. And I think we were talking about Serbian culture, like especially now with the NBA, you know, the MVP, how he keeps going back and he keeps talking about Serbia. There's this one famous interviewer who asked him, were you at all like touched by the or like at least impacted by the like boos at this one game? And he just responds with, brother, I played in Serbia. Like, so that's funny. Like a lot more Americans, I feel, are catching on to our Serbian culture, which is great.
Yeah, Jokic and a bunch of other people have made really big strides in the NBA. And it is interesting to see. I mean, like, American cultural knowledge is completely contained by do they play in our sports or not? but it is not. Yeah, it's nice to see that. Like. That people can be like gain a little bit of understanding of other places. I mean, I know, especially with, you know, the events that have happened since the war in Ukraine has started, people have very much shifted to like specifically Ukraine, Russia, and, or just different elements of it that are not really, don't have cultural or historical ties, but it is interesting to see people doing a lot more, at least for me, like perceived, like doing research and looking into topics involved in just Eastern and Southern Europe in general. Historically and trying to make ties to stuff historically and then connect that to the war.
Yeah, that's, I mean, you mentioned in Serbia about how a lot of those connections kind of run deep with Russia. Do you think that'll eventually fade away with the youth, or is that, will there always be sort of that anchor base support?
Well, I think, I'm more leaning towards the side that it's going to stay here for a while. The reason being that when we're looking at Serbian, I guess, political ideology as a whole, this is not a very accurate or let's say like valid way of splitting up politics in Europe. But for now, for example, if you compare the stances towards LGBT or immigration of Western Europe versus Eastern Europe, let's say Hungary or Poland, especially Poland, you'll see that Eastern Europe tends to be more conservative on these type of things, on these type of topics. And so my opinion is that even if we start becoming, let's say, more progressive in the sense that we start maybe going away from Russia and going more pro-European Union, stuff like that, the conservative values will always stay there. And I think that means that the Orthodox beliefs are going to stay in Serbia. Serbia definitely is very attached to those type of things. And the love that they have for Russia isn't going away. And I think even the youth, even if they're, let's say, pro-Ukraine in the war, that's not to say that they're anti-Russia. And I think far from that, actually. They're just saying that Serbia shouldn't get involved in that conflict and we can just back, you know, what other Western powers are doing. But that, I mean, to a large extent, the reason as to why Serbia exists today and why it wasn't wiped out was thanks to the Soviets and thanks to the efforts of of Russia in multiple different of, let's say, events in world history. I think, our wars mentioned this earlier, before the First World War, but especially the Second. So I think that love that Serbs have for Russia is going to stay for a long time. And I don't think it'll get mixed up with the political ideology. I think that's the best way to summarize it. So even if we start moving away from Russia politically, that love for Russian culture and our, let's say, like what a lot of people here call our Orthodox Slavic brothers won't go. And I think Serbs do differentiate between that politics and culture aspect of it. So I think that's really interesting.
I was going to mention that as well, that it's something that I think a lot of people have a hard time understanding, especially if they're American, because we, you know, us as Americans, we have some connections to other, like, you know, groups that are similar to us historically, and people have their connections to their home countries, and aspects of that do come through in American culture where we celebrate that. But America of itself has a very short history, and one that is not particularly, you know, homogeneously aligned on political movements or beliefs or connections of such brotherhood or, like, you know, fraternity or whatever. I think it's something that a lot of Americans can't understand, where there is like a differentiation of like supporting Russia in the war and like supporting the Russian people, or like being close to, like, you know, like close to them through, like, as you said, like Orthodox sort of connection, or Orthodox Slavic connection.
Yeah, absolutely. If I may add as well to that, I think it's also interesting because it's not only like Russia having influence over it. I see a lot of, I'm going to say reactionary, but I don't mean reactionary in the like traditional definition. I mean reactionary just in the fact that it's based off like quick judgment, very quick reaction. That when, for example, there was going to be a Pride March in Belgrade, I think last year, and a lot of Serbs were like very against it. I mean, this was particularly, let's say, the more like right-winged parties of Serbia, and the more conservative traditional ones. And they fully rioted against seeing LGBT marches. And so, like, there are some...
Yeah, so you mentioned, I guess there will always be that sort of, that block that maintains some pro-Russian... Like you said, I don't think there's necessarily anything wrong with that. You know, there's, you know, Arwars was mentioning about how kind of the U.S., you know, the cultural melting pot has side effects that sort of change the dynamic in a way that Europe doesn't really see.
I think also,
go ahead.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Oh, yeah, okay. I just wanted to say one thing. You know, obviously this is not my opinion, but it's not because I'm half Serbian that I'm saying this. This is just my observation from what I see in Serbia generally. And with a lot of relatives that I've spoken to, I often ask them a lot of questions about, you know, what they think about NATO, and, you know, despite what NATO did to Belgrade and stuff in the 90s, you know, what their general opinions are and where they're coming from and stuff. And, you know, from, like, let's say a Serbian perspective, you can only kind of understand where they're coming from. And, you know, I mean, the average Serb really didn't want all that violence to happen in the Balkan Wars, especially the ones, I mean, the third Balkan Wars in the 90s. And so, you know, Serbia did a lot of wrong things in the Balkan Wars. I think so did every Balkan country, really. But yeah, you know, the thing is, a lot of the NATO operations did just destroy a bunch of innocent buildings and killed a lot of innocent people. And so a lot of people do view NATO as like these killers, whereas they remember, you know, that sort of, not necessarily nostalgia, but also that sort of allegiance to Russia, because not only did Russia help Serbia become the state that it is today, but because Russia has always been backing Serbia through, let's say, thick and thin. So the average Serb will obviously, especially now in the context of the war, decide to kind of like return the favor in a way. And that's that sort of behavior that I've really noticed. And I think that's precisely why the youth is less pro-Russia than the older generations, is because they haven't experienced that firsthand. And so they don't necessarily feel the need to be like returning the favor per se, or they don't feel the need to have that allegiance to Russia. Whereas older generations, they would have seen what NATO did in Belgrade. They would have seen just the collapse of Yugoslavia, all of that. And so for them, you know, Russia is kind of more appreciated, I suppose. And like I said, like, my opinion is, like, I'm not pro-Russia at all in the conflict with Ukraine, but it's just my observations from what's happening in Serbia. Like, you, especially when you're on the ground or you have relatives in Serbia, you can only understand why most older generations have those sort of ideologies or beliefs.
Do you think, so moving more internally with Serbia's, particularly with its issues with Kosovo, its own... I guess I hesitate to call it a socio-political or social division because I don't know if it's as severe enough to call it that. But do you think there's a potential for a tinderbox where because we saw a little bit where I think it was the K4 headquarters was being not attacked, but it was kind of surrounded and pressure was being put upon it, certainly. Do you think there's a propensity for a renewed conflict in the region? Or is that something that's a little bit too far? There's too many levers that need to be switched in a way for that to happen. Is it too far gone? And it's just a matter of kind of handing the baton off to the younger generations.
No, honestly, I think there's absolutely room for escalating tensions and even a potential conflict. If anything, I'm more skeptical about there being peace in Kosovo than there being, you know, like, let's say, a conflict. I think a conflict is more likely. The reason being is not only have we seen a lot of tensions recently, but I think especially with the Vucic government that we have now, it almost feels like they're going to use what's happening in Ukraine as an excuse to try and march into Kosovo and try and get backup from Russia, perhaps. But regardless of that, I think it's mostly just because of the way, you know, like there's this, from my analysis, it's obviously Serbia, in my opinion, this is my opinion now. And from, I've written a lot of essays on this. In my opinion, Serbia was absolutely wrong in the 90s. But in, let's say, contemporary terms, in 2023, I think that what Kosovo is doing internally is also wrong. And I think it, when you see a lot of the way a lot of the Serb majority towns in Kosovo are being treated, I understand why there's tensions. So obviously this whole situation could have just been avoided, in my opinion. But obviously Kosovo is, I mean, it goes really back in history. I mean, I think it's around 95% of the population there is Albanian, or ethnic Albanian. And so the thing is, the vast majority of Kosovo isn't Serb, so they seek independence. But there's still a lot of Serb majority towns. And so recently what they've been doing is they've been boycotting Kosovar elections, and they've been really, really frustrated at the fact the Kosovar government is trying to ban their license plates, basically like ban Serbs from specific jobs, stuff like that. And I think one of the main remarks is also that the Kosovar police force has a lot of former UÇK fighters. UÇK is just the KLA, which is the Kosovo Liberation Army. And obviously like a lot of Serbs view the KLA as like terrorists. And so for them, it's like unacceptable. It's unimaginable that Kosovo has not only their own police, but the fact that a lot of them are former KLA guys. Well, I would say not a lot. I think that obviously is decreasing now. But so like tension, in my opinion, is guaranteed. Whether there's going to be a full-scale conflict just depends on what happens with the Serbian government. Because in my opinion, the Kosovo government doesn't really want to go to war. But Vucic is sort of like that hot-headed, unpredictable actor here. And I think it all depends on how he starts leaning in terms of Russia and Ukraine, which is why I think it's so impactful on Serbia, is because I'm generally persuaded that Vucic's decision on what to do with Kosovo, especially after that resolution 1244 that they passed a few days ago, is entirely dependent on how he's going to decide to consider, like, is Serbia pro-Russia? Is Serbia not pro-Russia? Like all that kind of stuff. And so I think, I mean, the tension just keeps getting worse and worse. And you've had Serbs mobilizing at the border. You've even had a few gunshots a few months ago. Nobody was hurt. I mean, honestly, luckily, because that would have been just fully the start of a conflict. But there's like this famous, like, I guess it's not a saying, but it's a kind of a joke. Even in the Balkans, I suppose most people know, the Balkan people love to drink. And so there's like this kind of dark joke that all it would take for another conflict in Kosovo would be just a drunk night in a bar. In Kosovo, it just takes one guy to be drunk, start fighting, pull out a gun, and then that would be it, you know? So I think we are closer to a conflict than there is peace. And I think it's been like that for years now, but obviously I'm hoping nothing happens because that would just be bad for no reason.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, we'd love to have you back on the podcast again, because if that happens, you're probably going to get drafted, but I'm just teasing you, but luckily, I think there's a lot of truth in what you,
Yeah, sorry, go on.
Hopefully you can make it back to university and avoid all that. But there's a lot of truth in what you said. And one of the things both myself and our wars have been looking at is this slowly, I think there's been kind of a rearmament of, at least on Kosovo's side. I covered this was back in mid-July. Kosovo picked up, I believe it was unconfirmed 5, but a number of Bayraktar TB2 drones, the UCAVs, whatever you want to call them. drones for all intents and purposes, that have been kind of famous. So for those, I can't imagine too many that don't know, the Bayraktar TB2s are these attack drones that can carry precision guided munitions. They've been pretty famous in Nagorno-Karabakh, of course, in Ukraine.
Yep.
They've seen some time in Libya. They are, from what we've seen, pretty deadly. And even if they're not armed or using their armaments, they are extremely helpful in an ISR, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance role. They picked up a couple of those. And then I think including, during our reading a quote from Defense Minister, oh no, I'm sorry, this is from Kosovo Prime Minister Albin Kurti. During our two-year administration, we have increased the number of soldiers by over 80% and the military budget by over 100%. Kosovo is even safer, he says. That kind of goes into a whole thing where they promised to increase the size of their armed forces to at least 5,000 active duty service members and a minimum of 3,000 reservists. Now, that doesn't seem like a lot of troops, but in the small space that they would have to fight and defend or assault or whatever you want to put it as, that can, those can, those numbers mean something. Especially when you know that area better than any of us. That's what, semi-mountainous villages. I mean,
Yep.
That's pretty.
It's also about the infrastructure there. I mean, the roads. There's not a very complex road network. So if there's like one road that's blown up, that's almost every single entry into a specific village. You know, so.
Yeah, and so it's interesting to think. At least my tactical mind wanders what a conflict like that would look like. I can't imagine it would go as long, be as brutal or as widespread as, the Balkan Wars of the 90s, certainly the early 90s. I can't imagine it would go to that scale just because of A, international pressure, ideally from both sides, but certainly from the West. And I'm also just because the numbers and the technology being used, I don't know. I would be interested to hear your side of that, of how, I guess, ultimately, what would a renewed conflict even look like?
I mean, in my opinion, it would be terrible for Serbia, just because of the way allies function, especially in modern politics. I mean, the thing is, I'm not sure if the West would, or let's confine it to just the EU for now, because I think if we say the West, obviously the United States has a big role there as well. But I'm not sure if they would fully mobilize just to completely defend Kosovo. But I think the consequences would be far worse for Serbia than they are for Kosovo, especially now when you see Russia is somewhat suffering internally, especially with its economy and stuff, with what they're doing in Ukraine. Serbia has nowhere near the size that Russia has. And Kosovo has a lot more direct backing from the West, especially with the K4 units and stuff. Now, don't get me wrong, Ukraine is getting far more weapons and far more, let's say, material support from the West than Kosovo. But regardless, if Serbia was to launch, let's say, an attack or let's say a reconquer, whatever you think is the right term here, to into Kosovo, I think it would just be horrible for both sides. It would literally be zero winning points on either side, and I think Serbia would really get harmed a lot more.
That's interesting. And do you think it would be because of that Western backing, or purely because of a mismatch or a battlefield tech doctrine?
No, I think it would be because I mean, Serbia for quite a couple of years now, you know, whether our politicians want to admit it or not, are trying to get somewhat closer to the West. Not, don't get me wrong, obviously nothing to do with NATO. I don't think Serbia will ever join NATO just because everyone hates it in Serbia. But I think they are trying to at least make efforts to join the European Union. And there's been dispute because the EU has almost just directly said that they won't even consider Serbia's entrance into the EU if they don't recognize Kosovo, which is a whole different issue by itself. But
right,
just because of that backing for Kosovo and Kosovo's independence by European powers, I mean, Serbia is already practically in a tricky situation just because they're not openly pro-Ukraine. I can't even imagine what it would be like if they were at a war against a Western-backed state, you know? So,
do you think the NATO, the EU, the US, do you think they'd really get involved that much? Or would it be sort of, we don't want to repeat what happened in the 90s with the bombing of Belgrade. We don't want to repeat that. why don't we keep our hands off and just let this kind of solve itself? Or what do you think?
I just think that the K4 units would just be given the peace enforcement mandate and they would just be allowed to just defend Kosovo. I think that's the most rational thing. I don't think it would be outright mobilization by Western powers. Especially not, you know, I don't know if this is like, let's say, a correct thing to say, but I think especially not because of how people have been seeing the war in Ukraine. Like a lot of people, let's say, you know, don't understand why their country is getting involved in a war that's not theirs. And I see a lot of people saying that actually on social media recently. I've seen a lot more people say that for some reason. You know, people from, Western Europe predominantly, a lot of French people actually back home talk about that because there's been so much inflation and so much, you know, money being spent on helping Ukraine. Mm. And I think if people started seeing, let's say, Western Europe start even putting more funds just to support Kosovo, I think that wouldn't please them too much. So I don't think there would be that much mobilization behind it. But there would still be definitely movement like to try and defend Kosovo.
Yeah, I could see that in more of a peacekeeping or peace enforcement deployment than any actual, you know, dumping of money or arms.
Yeah, no, for sure.
I agree with you. The Europeans can only handle one major war at a time. They're not going to take on another.
Yeah, no, for sure.
That's interesting to think about. I mean, and then what other players in the region do you think, if any, would even get involved? Do you think Albania would put a hand, throw their hat in? Or,
I mean, Kosovo is already heavily supported by Albania. Albania helps with training, a bunch of different stuff. I mean, Albania is quite open about it. In terms of other actors, I think for once the Balkans would try not to get too involved. I'm not sure if Croatia, Bosnia, Slovenia would try and do anything about it. I think they would just mind their own business. But I think here the main one to talk about is the UN, the West, versus kind of Serbia being isolated. And to be completely honest with you, I don't even know if Russia would help Serbia out that much because they have their own war to worry about in Ukraine. So I think we were talking about the rumors of Wagner earlier. I think that would literally be the only external support that Serbia would get in the case of an invasion. So
I can see that. Yeah, and I don't think you'd get much from the Kremlin. They've got it. You know, I talked a while ago. I don't know if it was on this podcast or somewhere else, but I talked a little bit about Armenia and Azerbaijan. And it's like Armenia, I think at this point, has realized they're not getting any help from the Kremlin because all of Russia's resources are dumped into Ukraine. If they're going to fight Azerbaijan, it's purely with what they have in their pockets right now. I think that would be the same thing for Serbia. Anything they take on with Kosovo, it's going to be with what you've got in your pockets and what's in your backpack right now.
It's going to be a very lonely conflict. I think even for both sides, I think it would just be lonely.
Yeah.
To each their own.
Exactly. I mean, it would be hard to say. I don't know. It almost would be like its own little war between. It would almost be like the most pure war that there is because everybody just doesn't either A, cannot, will not, or just doesn't have the resources to get involved in a strange roundabout way. I know, maybe not the most pure, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. No, I agree. I can back that.
Definitely.
I do have one. I don't even know if I'm allowed to ask this question or if you're going to get mad at me if I ask this question.
No, go ahead. It's fine.
But purely because I watched this movie Behind Enemy Lines like a couple of weeks ago, which is one of my favorite movies. Also because I love Owen Wilson. And the only thing I wish he said more, we need more wow. We need more wows in that movie, but it's an awesome movie. For those that haven't seen it, it's an old movie. Behind Enemy? It's a 2001. Wow, that's super old now.
But I wasn't even born yet.
yeah, that's an old. But anyways, it's Gene Hackman. It's Owen Wilson at their best. Basically, it's a little on the nose, but it's not supposed to be. Basically, the NATO air campaign. Anyways, and there's this whole like the enemy, who you never really get to know who they actually are. But anybody who takes 5 minutes and does a cursory research can know it's Archon's Tigers. So I read a book. I can't remember. Chasing the Tiger, I think, is the name of it. A while back. Phenomenal book. just because I was fascinated by this, how this thing even came to be. Is there still I'm trying to remember support, the guy's name. Zhilko Raznatovich?
Oh, yeah. I mean, just Arkan, basically, yeah.
Arkan is what he goes by. Does that still have, like,
him,
a following?
Everybody refers to him as Arkan, yeah. But his name is Zhilko Raznatovich. And, you know, you'd be surprised. Like, I actually find out more and more about his current legacy in Serbia. Like, when he was still alive, he was married to an extremely famous singer here in Serbia. Her name is Teta. And she's still alive, and she doesn't want to marry anyone else. Like, in Serbia, it's become quite, like, a thing.
I think it's her or his daughters are, like, Instagram famous. Like, millions of
followers. Yeah. And you'd be surprised at how much, like, the Arkan legacy is still, like, exists. But it's very controversial. I don't mean the legacy as in, like, people support him or people, like, don't support him. But you can still feel, like, for example, I'm not sure if you guys know this, but Arkan was a member of the Red Star Football Club Hooligans. Like, he was part of the Delhi.
Yeah, that's where he got his start.
And so when they were getting their operations in Croatia and in Bosnia, there were a lot of Red Star Hooligans with him. And right in front of the stadium of the Red Star Football Club, you have Arkan's house. And it still exists, and no one touches it. And it's one of the rare buildings in Serbia where there's absolutely no graffiti. And Cica, his wife, I guess, if you can still call her that, still lives there.
The widow, I guess?
Yeah, that's the right term, I suppose. She still lives there. And, like, people still know that's his house. And I guess people don't really say it out loud. No one, like, goes pointing at it saying, oh, that's Arkan's house. But, you know, like, everyone knows it. For sure. He's still talked about. I wouldn't say people support him, though. I think far from that. But I also wouldn't say people condemn him. I think it's just kind of like that kind of topic, you know, that no one really wants to talk about.
Interesting. That is fascinating to me because I wasn't into him like in a, I guess, a negative or destructive way. I was just fascinated by the fact that somebody like this and an organization like this could essentially come to power. And like you said, his military, if you look at the history of it, actually basically grew out of a soccer hooligan group.
He even bought his own football team and brought them to the Champions League.
Oh my God. Yeah. Basically, and then they grew into, I don't know, a lot of tacticians and military buffs will argue about their effectiveness on the battlefield, but arguably one of the more tactically superior, albeit they did some heinous things, some pretty messed up things.
Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah. I mean, war crimes, the whole list.
Oh, yeah. For sure. Yeah, I'm not condemning. I am condemning. I'm not condoning any of that. But from a purely tactical standpoint, you could argue that they were one of the more militarily effective units on the field, especially when you were dealing with a mixture of regular army, militia, guerrilla, and then units like this. They were one of the arguably better, more effective in terms that they could seize territory and hold it.
I mean, they gained that notoriety for that, you know, just because of how effective they were, and they were just a bunch of just Serbian ultra nationalists. But yeah, I mean, you know, it's interesting because a lot of the time, foreigners don't understand that he's still like he's dead, but it still feels like he's alive because of how much like his presence is still there in a way. Like, I know that sounds like it's weird to explain, and obviously, no one like supports him, I guess, but no one is against him. Like I said, it's just kind of that one topic you don't really talk about, but his house is still there. His, like, you know, all of that is still very present. So people like know, like, Arkan was there.
Arkan was there.
That is interesting. He has that legacy.
Yeah.
And kind of, it's, I mean, not probably in the same level of immortalized, but it reminds me of other very controversial figures being held very esteemed in countries, mostly just because of like their like devotion to like, or the perception of their devotion to like the national interest of the country, despite like whatever bad shit they did.
Yeah.
I had a question for you, Antoine. Out of your experience with different insurgency groups, what's like one that's your favorite, or like, you know, quote unquote, you know, not like here, but you know, like to have learned about or that you find the most interesting?
Yeah. So actually, now I'm
what's your favorite Jet Squad?
Yeah, for that answer, I'm gonna have to highlight that this has nothing to do with like my own journalist like endeavors or anything. This has nothing to do with the modern surgery. I'm going to be talking just my own opinion now. Honestly, the most interesting one I've read about has to be these French winemakers who blow stuff up to protect their own wine in the south of France. Like they're the most French militants you can ever think about, ever, really. It's a real group. It's called the CRAV. That's the abbreviation, the CRAV. And I think in English, it's the Regional Committee for Viticultural Action. It's like these French radical winemakers who are really pissed off about the high price of wine because of the European Union. So they blow up like wineries. They blow up trucks transporting wine. They even sent death threats to French presidents telling them like, you have to protect our wine, otherwise bad things are going to happen or we're going to come kill you and stuff.
And it's like apparently it's French, a big destruction of non-French wine. It seems to be one of their biggest
qualms. Yeah. I'm surprised you know about them. Yeah, they're very openly against Algerian wine.
I just googled all them. Of that.
Oh, okay, fair enough. No, you got me excited. I thought you knew about them too, man.
Dude, 1907, they've been around for a while.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's from the... Like, 1907 wasn't directly the CRAV, but it was the original movement that started all of that. I think in 1907, that's when France started importing Algerian wine. And so the southern French like winemakers were pissed off that no one wanted to buy their wine anymore because it was too expensive. So that's when the movement started, and it still exists today, but now it's like a full organization. And you can type them up. They were like balaclavas with a beret on top. So that's like honestly as French as you can think. Balaclavas with a beret, and they just blow up stuff and they set wineries on fire. It's crazy. And so when I read about that, I mean, the whole point of what we do at The Modern Insurgent is to find very underreported insurgencies or like very niche political ideologies. And I think that's like the pinnacle of that, really. Like radical French winemakers.
Now that's a movement I can kind of get behind, though. Because
president for wine is very French. That's like the pinnacle of France, like French protests.
I can get behind that because of all the things that will be messed with by the government in my life, do not mess with my drink.
Especially not for the French. They love the wine. So.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's one of the few things that lets us deal with the depravity of life, especially with what we do, digging into open source intelligence and terror groups and... goodness gracious, wow, that's
that was a way better answer than anything I could have I was just gonna go with like it, in my mind when I was thinking of my answer, I was thinking of something very typical, so that was a much better answer than I would have given.
Yeah, I have to think outside the box, otherwise anything else is too biased, you know. I have to find a way of answering the question but also giving a pretty cool answer.
That's just an extremely cool answer. What else do we got? We've covered quite the bit today.
I mean, from Serbia to Georgia to French winemakers, we've covered the deal.
Yeah. We talked the dancing lady. We talked about proving your manhood in the mountains.
Mitch McConnell getting knocked out frozen in Parliament.
Yeah, religious
vampires from Serbia.
We've done it all tonight.
If that's not enough to subscribe to Atlas Plus, I don't know. I don't know what is.
I think that is.
And Modern Insurgent, don't forget.
Thanks for the plug.
Yeah, no worries.
Yeah, by all means, if you haven't already, go check out the Modern Insurgent. Is it themoderninsurgent.org or just moderninsurgent.org?
The website is just moderninsurgent.org.
Moderninsurgent.org. Check them out. Give them a like, give them a follow, and definitely, I know you. Every time I check it out, you guys have new content coming up, whether it's a new documentary, obviously constantly with your team of writers, new articles. Definitely should be on your bookmarks and your subscribe lists for sure.
And on Instagram especially, because you guys are always putting out just really cool posts about, like, for anyone who doesn't follow, they just put out like a very large amount of unique posts about different insurgent groups, is highlighting like the political aspirations, historical backgrounds, and sort of just their current status of these groups. So it's nice because it's a lot of groups you would probably never hear about anywhere else.
Hell yeah. Thanks for the plug, guys.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Man. It was a pleasure and an honor having you on the show.
It's great.
We'll probably have you back, I would imagine, and we'll give it some time, but as we talked about, it's only a matter of time until something kicks off again, and we'll have to bring you back on. And hopefully you won't get drafted, like I said. But no, I think you'll be okay, and we'll circle back around. Other than that, any final words for us, Antoine?
Nothing else other than thank you so much for inviting me on, and I'll talk to all of you soon.
Make sure you subscribe, awesome. Everyone. For all of us here at the Atlas Plus Working Title Podcast, we'll see you later.